Thank you very much, Michael, for this friendly introduction. As you might have noticed, all the time during the last sessions, he has introduced speakers, and he has said that there are specialists on mantic practices or specialists on prognostication or some such things. I am not a specialist. I'm not working on such practices that sometimes would be called esoteric. I'm not dealing with mantic practices or astrology. But my concern is to highlight how processes of modernization have influenced religious concepts of fate and freedom, and also how these concepts of fate and freedom have changed. My field of interest is, to tell all of you who don't know yet, especially the 19th and early centuries. So that means specifically modern developments. And today I would like to emphasize on one example, which is, as you will see, also related to the concern of prognosis. It is the meditation movement in Myanmar. And you might wonder how prognosis and meditation go together, but I will try to show you today. Since I'm not a sinologist and I'm not a historian, as you have heard, and I'm a scholar of religious studies, I would like to take a little detour today and would like to say a couple of things about religious studies in this context. What I will present today is a small part of a larger research project which I'm involved in, and that is a project on how the concept of mindfulness, in German Achtsamkeit, as a philosophical concept as well as a practice of meditation in the West has been received since the 20th century from Buddhist traditions. And I ask, why is this concept and this practice at present far beyond religion so prominent in the field of medicine, psychotherapy, neuroscience, the educational system, management training, and finally also in popular culture? It is not an exaggeration to say that mindfulness at present is the most popular term or keyword even when the training of the mind and the technologies of self are debated. In the beginning, I would like to show you a diagram which one of my doctoral students has brought last year from a conference in Berlin. And this diagram shows that between 1980 and 2000, annually an average of 20 articles on mindfulness have been published. And 2005, approximately 80 publications, and in 2010, finally 360 publications demonstrate the actual relevance or the actuality of the research in this field. Buddhism and Buddhist-inspired practices are more prevalent in the West today than in any time in history. As different versions of Buddhist practice, which would traditionally have remained separated by national borders, as they come together in the global community, new forms of Buddhism emerge. And it, in this context, is increasingly important to understand earlier interactions of Buddhist countries, of Buddhists with the Western world. Buddhist interaction with the West has traditionally been traced to a small number of educated elites who traveled into the Eastern world and brought the religious practice which they found there back to Europe or to the US. Many, if not most, attempts to analyze the conception between Asian and European movements and their cooperation in this period were plagued by the same problem, and that is replicating white authority and privilege. In this picture you see a colonel called Henry Steele Olcott, one of the founders of the so-called Theosophical Society. In the history of Buddhist revival in Theravadin, South and Southeast Asia, the founder of this Theosophical Society, Olcock, and his career are exemplify many of the issues that are involved, particularly the ways in which he was perceived as a right advocate for Sri Lankan Buddhists in their struggle against Christian missionaries and colonial representations. And yet, he came to promote, through his Buddhist catechism, a particular interpretation of Buddhism, which is shaped by his own American background, his own American Protestant, as well as spiritualistic background, and he also shaped, to a wide extent, the development of Buddhism in South Asia and Southeast Asia. Similarly, studies on early Orientalists like Thomas Rhys Davids or his wife Caroline Rhys Davids and other key Theosophists, particularly Madame Blavatsky and Annie Besant, have highlighted how each, while claiming a metaphysical connection to Asia and Asians, served to reinforce colonial authority. For the most part, the movements of this era, helped and served to reproduce, reinvent, or invert the division between East and West, but they could never transcend completely colonial differences, this division between East and West. Theorists in colonial studies and post-colonial studies, Michael Lackner has mentioned that I have done some study in this field, like Partha Chatterjee and Deepesh Chakrabarti, have argued that even though nationalist independent movements in Asia had successfully reversed the priorities of power dynamics of the colonial state, elevating the spiritual traditions of the East over the material technologies of the West, all they had achieved, nevertheless, was to invert the two sides of power differential. My plan for the next year in this consortium on faith, freedom, and prognostication is to get involved into a deeper study of the Theosophical movement and Western esotericism during the Victorian era in order to see what impact their practices and theories had on the development of a Western popular Buddhism. But today I would like to give you one example, and this is an example that first of all puts all these post-colonial informed generalizations with which we have to deal all the time into question. So I will turn the coin in a way. Reformed Buddhism, Buddhist Renaissance, Protestant Buddhism, Buddhist Modernism. These are only some terms or definitions used to describe the meditation movements that developed in South and Southeast Asia in the 19th century. But in my opinion, these terms or definitions give reason to further questions. Is the Renaissance of the meditation movement a revival of an age-old practice from Buddhist tradition, or is it something generally new? Is Protestant Buddhism an extension and transference of practices that have traditionally been limited to or reserved to monks? Is it a transference to lay people? And finally, does modernization of Buddhism mean that Western impact was necessary to initiate this reform among Buddhists? Or are there indigenous traditions on which Buddhists in Southeast Asia could rely on? And I will focus today on one tradition which is genuine Buddhist and genuine from the Buddhist tradition and which has developed before Orientalist Western representation of Asia, of Buddhism, of Hinduism, of Asian spirituality could have an influence or an impact. How problematic the questions are becomes clear if we take a first look at classical literature on meditation. Edward Conze, in his introduction to his 1956 book Buddhist Meditation, writes, "Meditational practices constitute the very core of Buddhist approach to life. An intensely practical religion, Buddhism is by contrast inclined to treat doctrinal definition and historical facts with some degrees of unconcern. As prayer in Christianity, so meditation is here the very heartbeat of the religion." And 50 years later, Charles Allen, in his book The Buddha and the Sahibs, in which he describes Western Buddhological studies and does research on them, states that the practice of meditation in the 19th century in the countries of Theravada Buddhism has completely died out. Only the initiative of the Theosophical Society and the Ceylonese Reform Buddhist Anagarika Dhammapada have revived it as lay meditation. He says, traditionally confined to monks, passed down from master to pupil by personal and private initiation, the practice has died out entirely in Ceylon, Burma, and Siam. So the question is now, is meditation the basis for Buddhism, or is it not? Is mindfulness something new, or is it traditional and the basis of all Buddhist philosophy and religion, as Conze suggests, and as in Germany, Lambert Schmidhausen, a professor in Buddhological studies from Hamburg, has also tried to prove. Robert Scharf, who is one of the main deconstructors of modern Buddhist reform movements, on the other hand, is pretty clear in his view. The rationalization of meditation, coupled with Western values of the middle class patrons of urban meditation centers, led naturally to a de-emphasis on the traditional soteriological goal, that is, bringing an end to rebirth. Today I would like to focus on the beginnings of this meditation movement in Burma, and I want to question Sharp's view, and I want to do it by articulating a couple of leading theses. Modernization of Buddhism by the meditation movement in Burma is, other than it has been probably the case in Sri Lanka, not a product of Western Orientalism in the sense of a mimetic transference or even a mimicry of Western representations of Buddhism. Second, the role of Burmese Buddhists in a creative reaction to concrete historical conditions should not be underestimated. Third, their role can be seen in an independent, and this is the most important, in an independent appropriation of apocalyptic traditions that have been unknown until then by the Western, or for the Western Orientalists. And that means the label Protestant Buddhism, which is rumoring all around, is at least for the early phase of this movement inappropriate. We can even say that if we look at different developments in Asia, we can talk about multiple modernities, to use the expression of Shamuel Eisenstadt, multiple modernities even within South and Southeast Asia. And the last thesis, Buddha's modernization in Burma with the introduction of lay meditation is not to be interpreted as rationalization or secularization in the sense of limiting the role of religion and the influence of the monk order and the Sangha on society, but it is a collective expression of a new awareness of contingency. With Niklas Luhmann, we can call this a shift from an awareness of danger to risk. And I would like to talk a little about this. Luhmann characterizes the relationship of modern societies to future damage in contrast to pre-modern societies as this transformation from danger to risk. We can only speak about risk when a decision can be observed, a decision to which the occurrence of damage can be attributed. If unknown damages are articulated as danger, they are in a way, according to Luhmann, externalized from society. Natural damages, natural catastrophes. If on the other hand they are categorized as risk, then they are created by decisions and have to be accounted for respectively. That means risks are essentially problems of decision and are closely related to semantics of theory of decision. The term risk has to be interpreted and analyzed in such a way that it is not an expression of causality of fate, accident, coincidence, divine order, or even the stars or such things, but part of an era of human causality. And therefore, Luhmann now argues, and it's quite interesting, that the society of risk as a modern society begins with industrialization. It is interesting because it is a little different from the Munich-based sociologist Ulrich Beck, who talks about Weltrisikogesellschaft, what world risk society, if you want. And he argues that the Weltrisikogesellschaft is a post-industrial society, while for Luhmann it is the process of modernization and not post-modernization, so to say. Under the conditions of modern societies, the dangers we are confronted with are not predominantly natural dangers anymore. To calculate a risk means to, in a way, to begin to rule over time and to discipline the future. Any stabilization of security expands the horizon of possibilities for human action, and therefore also the power of institutions that promise securities are expanded. Since risk is based always on the difference between reality and possibility, risk implies at the same time a chance. So that means risks are at the same time also open for the future. The future to avoid future damages. With this preliminary remarks on the whole problem of modernization and risk society, I would like to come back to meditation. The modern conceptualization of religion as a category sui generis, that is, a category separated from political power, indeed has been effective in transforming the influence of Buddhism on Burmese society. A new interpretation of traditional perceptions of two aspects show where the meditation movement in Burma in the 19th century takes its start. And these are the aspects of decline and progress. This is an idea which I got from a conference which Thomas Fröhlich organized recently on the problem of progress in Chinese traditions, and I stole this idea from this conference, if you don't mind. Progress, as Reinhard Koselleck has argued, in opposition to decline, is a modern category, a category that was not experienced or even expected before the 18th century. Koselleck talks about Europe, now we talk about Myanmar. The topological reordering of concepts of decline, if you look at this quotation, which I will not read, the topological reordering of concepts of decline and their transformation into meditational practices can be observed in colonial Burma and especially so in the second part of the 19th century. Now we go into the matter of things. Between 1826 and 1948, British colonial dominance in Burma was established in three phases. Three successive wars led 1824 to 26, first to the annexation of the provinces of Arakan and Tanasserim. That is, these are the orange provinces in the south and in the west. Then in 1852 to the conquest of Pegu, that is the pink part. And finally in 1885 with the conquest of Mandalay as the royal capital of Burma. The whole of Burma came under British rule and the kingdom became a province of British India and as such a part of the Crown Colony. In 1885, the last Burmese king, Thibaw, was dethroned. Now, from 1830 on, and especially after 1852, colonialism became associated with a particular threat to the Sasana, and discussions on the decline of the Sasana, the Buddhist teaching, I will come back to what is Sasana later, became more focused and concrete. Although the 1826 annex of Arakan and Tanasserim was not interpreted as a challenge to Buddhism by the monks or lay people living in those era, it marked, in a way, the beginning of the Burmese perceptions of the British as a threat to the whole of Buddhism. Increased missionary activities and the arrival of mission printing presses in 1830 caused monks in particular to see Christianity as a challenge to Buddhist orthodoxy, one that had to be countered in a way in order to secure a strong future for Buddhism in that country. With the loss of territory in the Second Anglo-Burmese War in 1852, the problem became more acute. Large numbers of monks then fled from the area of Pegu into the northern part, or what is called Upper Burma, where they hoped to preserve Buddhism. According to Hittingaun, who studied monastic writings at that time, the migration was caused by a fear of living under a government that refused to be patron to Buddhism. So that means a government that argued that religion has nothing to do with political situation, and religion has to be separated, and the monks should decide who is their leader, who is the head of the Sangha, and such things, and not the king anymore. Now we come to the king. King Mindon was a king, the second last king of Myanmar, and his response to the defeat was to reassert the king's role, first of all, as the patron of the Sangha. He carried out numerous Buddhist projects, from founding the new capital in Mandalay, in the north of Myanmar, to be the home for the Dhamma, And in 1871, he convened the Fifth Buddhist Council, in which thousands of monks recited the Tripitaka, that is the canonical Buddhist text. And this Tripitaka was written down on marble stone shields or marble stone slabs and preserved in the Kutodo Pagoda near Mandalay Hill. This project of reciting the Tripitaka was a kind of enterprise to secure the status of the Sasana in Buddhist territory against threats from the so-called secular or British colonial south. King Mindon expanded the royal patronage for scholar monks and encouraged monks then to return to Lower Burma in order to ensure that, as missionaries, in order to assure that the Dhamma also would continue to be taught down there in the southern parts. Mindon's focus on Buddhist projects as a response to the British influence highlights the extent to which colonialism was felt not only as a political confrontation, but also as a cosmological threat. There was a perception that the arrival of new ideas and practices brought by colonialism was a danger, or let's say a risk to the Sasana, a risk that the Sasana was not able to withstand. Traditional concepts of decline, traditional prophecies of decline now became much more concrete. And this is the main focus of my talk today. But before, let me say a couple of other things. In his critique of Clifford Geertz, this morning we talked about him, Talal Asad has argued that religion cannot simply be interpreted as a symbolic system, but has to be seen as an important factor in a structure of power, a factor that even can take on a totalitarian character. So also in Myanmar, a country in which under colonial influence and the implementation of the secular government, the relationship of Buddhism and society has changed dramatically. Interestingly, in Burma, the interpretation of colonialism as a risk for the Buddha Sasana coincided with several aspects of innovation. Besides, of course, some resistance movements, militant resistance movements, we can identify several forms of the Sasana. Central was the rereading of canonical and non-canonical texts about decline of Buddhism. Second was the introduction of Pali classes and Pali exams for laity, and finally also the introduction of meditation for laity. Now the question is, which I tried to answer today, is how are these things related? Prophecies of decline, introduction of Pali text reading and study, and introduction of meditation. Understanding colonialism as speeding the decline of the Sasana, Buddhist lay people at the second half of the 19th century intervened with projects that would continue royal efforts to preserve Buddhism. Coming together in this way, Burmese Buddhists came to understand themselves as member of the community which have a certain task to cope with this danger, or again I would say to cope with this risk, a task with a specific cosmological purpose. Now I have used this term Sasana all the time, maybe some of you are not aware what it is. We can translate Sasana literally as teaching, or we can translate it as doctrine. But in the tradition, it has never been understood as a collection of text knowledge only. Sasana includes living practice in observing the teachings and their application, or even their extension in life, in society. And meditation, as you can see on the right hand, is one dominant aspect of this extension and application of Sasana teaching. Interesting, but this would be a different talk. In Burma, the concept of Sasana is not identical with what we call Buddhism as a religion, but in the 19th century, it became more and more, or it gained more and more the concept of religion as an organized entity. in which lay and monks are in a way related to each other as it has not been before. Interesting enough is that a missionary, his name is Adoniram Judson, the first Baptist missionary to Burma in the end of 18th century he came, has written a Pali-English dictionary in which he included or introduced a new term, Bot Dabara, which is a term which does not derive from traditional Burmese language, but is a new invention and is a kind of translation of what we call Buddhism as an organized religion. But this would be a different talk. I will not focus on this. In Theravada Buddhism, as you can you all read this foil? Is that large enough? In Theravada Buddhism, Pariyatti, which is completely left, is the learning of the theory of Buddha Dhamma as contained within the sutras of the Pali Canon. And it is related and at the same time contrasted to Patipatti, which means more or less to put theory into practice. And the third aspect is Pativeda, which means now to experience this relationship of teaching practice personally. And as you can see, meditation then is derived also from this practice. Theravada Buddhism accordingly has not been a religion confined to monks or to world renouncers. On to the contrary, it is a practice invoking an interchangeable relationship between monks and laities in which each section has its own duties. From my observation in Myanmar, collective rituals, holding collective rituals like mass meditation, today is much more important than individual rituals that are performed in pagodas. You can say whether I'm right or not, because we have been in Myanmar together. Now I just have this foil, you don't have to read it. It is a foil which shows that there is recently some research done on political developments in Burma and how the Buddhist response to colonial subjugation took various forms. And I want to mention only three of them. Three of them because they are the most important. The first was a millenarian movement called Veksa, or if you translate, withered cult, that planned or thought to bring back kingship, and they want to push forward and or hasten the arrival of a new Buddha, the Buddha Maitreya, the Buddha of the future, Maitreya in Sanskrit. The second was an independent struggle, the Taksims, who looked to Buddhism as a central point for shared national identity. I will not talk much about this movement today. They did so by combining nativist ideas with Western ideas and political ideologies. Buddhist scriptures and practices served as tools for exploring incipient dimensions of for the Buddhist national identity. So they tried to promote revolution, so to say. And the third movement, which is my topic, is the Vipassana meditation movement, which emerged a little later than the earlier two, and was neither politically engaged initially, nor self-consciously directed to restoring the monarchy, like the Vaiksa movement. Now I will only concentrate on Vipassana. Vipassana revitalization, like the Vaiksa millenarian movement, was drawn from prophecy of Buddhist scriptures. Both these movements represented attempts to secure the moral cosmic order, as I said already, in the face of the overwhelming socio-political transformations. Both movements depended on meditation. There you can see two forms of meditation, samatha and vipassana. And both movements depended on these forms of meditation. In the Vaiksa movement, the samatha meditation was more important in the vipassana, the vipassana meditation. Both movements attempted to extend the cosmological order on which multiple forms of devotions and practices and beliefs might be situated. The background of this idea is that in Buddhist epistemology, we differentiate between conventional truths and ultimate truths, or it is differentiated. Conventional truth is the so-called commonly accepted truth, and the ultimate truth is the teaching of the Buddha Dhamma. These two kinds of truths are recognized in the Abhidhamma literature, according to which only four categories, namely mind, mental factors, mental formations and materiality, and nirvana, are classed as ultimate truths, and the rest are regarded as apparent or conventional truths. By using expressions about things as we use in normal language, which exist only in designation, that we are not telling a lie or saying something wrong, or as we nowadays in theoretical discourse always say, it is only constructed, or constructionism, but not so in Buddhism. We are merely speaking an apparent truth or a conventional truth, making use of conventional language without which no communication would be possible at all. But in ultimate truths, for example, there are not such conceptions as I or you or person or individual or abstract categories. There exist only five skandhas or khandhas made up of corporality, mind, mental circumstances. Only these, according to Theravada teachings, are real. They are not just designations, they actually exist in us and around us. And there is a little bit of difference between Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism, which we don't have to bother about today. Conventional truth, the first part, now allows for a variety of practices. And to these practices also prognosis, astrology, relic worship, and even forms of meditation belong. So these are all aspects of conventional truths. Unfortunately, since I don't know enough Burmese to have proper access to the study of this Vaiksa, the first cult, which appropriated astrology especially to a large extent, I have to limit myself to Vipassana movement, since we have documents in Pali and English. The Vaiksa movement is not studied yet, so please, those of you who are interested in astrology, it is an open field. However, what I can say from secondary research or from what I have read about this Vaiksa movement, as well as from contemporary, at those times, Western reports of missionaries and colonial officers, which I am in the moment still studying, these two movements, Vipassana and Vaiksa, emerge as distinct types. And both developed, as I said, in relation to concretions of prophecies. In the Vaiksa tradition, the prophecy of the end of the world of the world age, simultaneously with the end of the Buddhist kingship, motivated people to practice in such a way as to speed up the end of the world and to bring the new coming Buddha. So in order to shorten the future. So Weksa practices, tried to do this with alchemy and wizard practices, and as I said, astrological divination and this Samatha meditation. The Vipassana movement, on the other hand, was also focused on the end of the world age, but the aim was to stop the decline of the sasana and to extend the period until the Maitreya Buddha comes. And this they tried to do by means of purifying the laity's own actions and mental intentions. This program of revitalization drew from existing ideas of an original society in which the first king was elected on the basis of being the most moral person in the society. Now, I come to the question of decline. The preservation of the sasana has been the central rationale for religious reform throughout Burmese history. Based on the model of Ashoka from the Mahavamsa, kings undertook campaigns to reform the Sangha and promote perceived orthodoxy with an explicit purpose of ensuring conditions in which the sasana could live, could survive. There are some inscriptions from the 15th century, Kalyani inscription, so-called Kalyani inscription, in which it is announced that, I quote, that the king purified the sasana so that it would endure for 5,000 years. And this is a trope found in many dedicatory inscriptions from the 9th century until, that means the kingdom of Pagan, you remember, until the 19th century. Why do I know this? The inscriptions of the Kalyani, that is a river in the south of Myanmar, have been published and translated into English already in 1892. So we can, Buddhists from even we as Buddhist lay speakers, so to say, can know about what happened there. Jean Nathier studied Buddhist concepts of time and future. His famous book, Once Upon the Future Time, is a research that is, in my opinion, very helpful as a background for understanding the appropriation and contextualization of concepts of decline or prognoses of decline in 19th century Burma. Briefly, to summarize some of Nathier's ideas, Buddhist concepts of time are broken into kalpas or kappas or eons, which include the appearance of a number of different Buddhas, or it can even happen that there are no Buddhas at all come. There are various concepts. Time becomes further divided into an era of each Buddha's enlightenment and the duration of his teachings or his sasana. While the sasana translates, as I said, literally as teaching or instruction, the concept of Buddhist sasana has come to include not just his teachings as body of knowledge, but also the practices so that the conditions of sasana are flourishing. Enlightenment and realization of nirvana are most easily achieved when the Buddha is present on earth. From the moment of Buddha's entry into parinirvana, that means when the Buddha has died, the sasana, according to traditional Buddhist texts, begins a slow process, but inevitable process of decline. A process in which the teachings are forgotten, the practices are abandoned, and slowly everything is disappears. The length of this decline is a matter of dispute among the various Pali sources, but all agree that the Sasana will eventually disappear completely when all knowledges of the texts and practices are lost, setting the stage for the arrival of a new Buddha, of the next one. Maybe just in brackets, that Buddhism or the Buddha Sasana is also perceived as something which is impermanent, is of course a consequent application of the Buddhist theory of impermanence of all things. As you know, the so-called Trilakana, or three signs, are impermanence, dukkha, Leidhaftigkeit means suffering, and non-self, anatta. The interpretation now of colonial influence speeding the decline of the Sasana was paralleled in the 19th century with an increase of writings about the stage of the Sasana's future and decline. One of the most detailed accounts of the decline of the Sasana was already written by Buddha Ghosha, a commentary on one of the Nikayas, Anguttara Nikaya, in which the decline is described in five stages or five sequences which follow, in which the Sasana is going to appear. This account of Buddha Ghosha is, and his concept of the decline in five stages became the basis of a very influential narrative of decline in Burma at the end of the 19th century, and that is this text, Anagatavamsa. This text repeats, so to say, Buddha Ghosha's narrative, listing five stages at the loss of Adigama, Patipati, Pariyati, Linga, and Dhatu. The text is meant to be read as a set of predications taught by the Buddha to his disciple Shariputra, and it is a predication of the arrival of the future Buddha Maitreya. But most of the text is devoted to the concept of decline of the Sasana. By the end of the 19th century, more than 10,000 of copies have been circulated in Burma, and even today, meditation centers republish this text. I acquired a copy of the text in a meditation center of a very modern meditation master, Ubal Kin, in Yangon in 2011, where it is published again and again. A manuscript copy of this text was collected by the Petersburg Indologist Ivan Minayev during his visit to Burma in 1886. It was published in the Journal of the Pali Text Society, and Edward Conze, another famous Buddhist scholar, in his classic anthology Buddhist Texts Through the Ages, published a translation by Isalyn Blue Horner, one of the famous female Indologists, who lived also 1896 until 1981. She was a leading scholar of Pali literature and was late president of the Pali Text Society. Now, this is important for this whole question of Orientalism, post-colonial ideas, and so on. Minayev acquired this manuscript from a library of an influential lay figure among the Buddhists in Yangon, who was the honorary secretary of the Rangoon branch of the Mahabodhi Society. And he was the one who represented Burma to the society in Calcutta in early 1893. He was also traveling to Chicago, to the famous World Parliament of Religion. What I want to say with this, and I know this because Minna has explained everything as in the introduction to the publication of this text in the journal. Here we have a wonderful example of that the fact that traditional Buddhist scripts have gained importance in a society not by the influence or through the influence or conceptualization of Western Orientalists, but the Orientalists have been the ones who received copies of this text in this case and transferred it into English and transferred it to the West. So the other way around, it is not the Western representation of the East, but the Eastern representation of itself, which was interesting for the West. Now the Anagatawamsa offers a very detailed account of how the decline will happen, and with this I think I will slowly come to an end. And it seems to have, the text seems to have been a central text read in early Buddhist associations which formed in Burma, and therefore we can say this text, as I said, 10,000 of copies were circulated, it is a text that mirrors a 19th century Burmese concerns. The first disappearance, as you can see, the first disappearance of attainments is, or the loss of attainments, means now the end of the ability of monks to achieve the four stages, the four final stages on the path of nirvana, is that this disappeared, and that means there is an end of enlightened arhats in the Sangha. There is nobody in the Sangha who is able to come to nirvana. Just move here. This is a very traditional conceptualization of nirvana and how we get it in force, or how we get to it, sorry. The first is the stream entry, then only the second step is that we only once are reborn. Third step is there's no rebirth anymore. And the final step is the ahanship, that is the stage when somebody is really fit for nirvana, traditional conceptualization. This signals that there's no arhant in the Sangha anymore. There's a signal the end of the period that began following the Buddha's enlightenment, when it was easiest to become enlightened. And the hope of most lay people is not to achieve nirvana now. The central hope and wish of lay people is to be reborn in a time when a Buddha is on earth. So that means to be reborn when the next Buddha Maitreya comes, which will take a long time. The next stage is the loss of conduct or practice, in which monks progressively become unable to practice meditation, become unable to keep the rules of conduct, until ultimately the last monk breaks all the rules. Oh, they start drinking and eating meat and so on and so on. The third stage is the loss of pariyatti. In the Anagatawamsa, it is told that eventually all the scripts, all the books of the Tipitaka disappear, one sutra after the other, and it's a long text. It shows exactly when which text will disappear. And the fourth stage is the loss of outward appearances, the linga. It describes the decline in performative terms. It is concerned with the manner of the monks, their dress, their livelihood, their decline also in morals. It paints a picture of married monks, working monks. They have forgotten even the basic ideas of monastic behavior. That means, in fact, there are no monks anymore. And the final stage is very interesting, but does not concern us so much here, is the disappearance of relics. This is the Anagatavamsa offers a supernatural cosmic event in which all the relics in all the Buddhist countries are disappearing from their place, from their stupas, and somehow magically, and they reunite in Bodh Gaya, at the place of Buddha's enlightenment, and at this place they go up in flames. And so that means no relics are there, and this is of course a very serious matter, because then there is no chance for lay people to relate to the Buddha anymore. These images parallel a number of Burmese Buddhist concerns in the 19th century. The concern for the declining morality of the monks coincides with the late 18th and 19th century monastic reform movements and conflicts. There was, for example, the conflict about the robe wearing. Shall a monk cover both, when he's going into the streets, cover both shoulders, or, as in Sri Lanka, only one shoulder? It was such a conflict that the Sangha even separated about it. Probably more a conflict on practice than on doctrines, as we are used in Western traditions. The image of relics ultimately reuniting in Bodh Gaya has also a very interesting connotation when we realize that at the same time the so-called Mahabodhi Society, which came from Sri Lanka, from Ceylon, had the plan to rebuild Bodh Gaya as a Buddhist center, as a Buddhist pilgrim center, because at that time Bodh Gaya was completely in the hands of Brahmins, I mean, that means Hindus. So there was no Buddhist worship at the place of Bodh Gaya. Even Rudyard Kipling has written poems about this fact. The loss of Pariyatti, that means learning, corresponded directly with the concerns that the loss of royal patronage means the decline of the Sasana. As Minayev reported in 1886, there was the perception that Pariyatti was particularly threatened. He says, "There is an end to the teaching," the yellow robes whisper privately. In this way, the loss of learning would have had the most bearing or the most influence on the Burmese Buddhist lay anxieties in the last decades of the 19th century. And that is why they now, these Pali courses and Pali exams were introduced for the laity in order somehow to preserve traditional knowledge of the canon. And the loss of practice, Patipati, led to the idea that forms of meditation have to be taught to the laity now. Interesting is, and then I close, that the discourse about the situation of the Buddha Sasana was very controversial at that time, and during the 19th century it has shifted various times. There is a notice in a text, in a chronicle, called Sasana Vamsa. It's an important monastic chronicle from 1861. Which King Mindon, you remember him, has organized or has initiated, in which he categorically states that there are arhats in the Sangha. There are monks which are arhats. Until today, this chronicle is, which has been translated again for the Pali Text Society later, is a very important source for the reconstruction of the history of Burma, Buddhism in Burma. But it is also an expression of an attempt of the king Mindon, under conditions which are a risk or a danger for his kingdom, to establish a form of Buddhist orthodoxy. And this also meant that now the king himself started to meditate. So that means the introduction of Vipassana meditation for lay and for the king into wider circles of society was one of the most important reactions to the experience of crisis. Now I could continue about Vipassana longer. I just want to say briefly that there are hardly any notes about this Vipassana meditation before 1860, and only after after that time, all of a sudden, many commentaries on Vipassana meditation appeared. I have again looked at also Western and missionary sources, and I did not find any account to a to this meditation movement, Vipassana movement, in any of these Western sources of the mid-19th century. There is, and they have mentioned everything else, but not this meditation movement. Interesting now, again, the monks appeared as meditation masters. Meditation centers have been opened, and besides the Sangha, that means beside the monk order, lay meditation was introduced. There were a couple of very important teachers. One of the most important for us in the West is so-called Mahasi Sayadaw, which I will show here. Lady Sayadaw and Mahasi Sayadaw are the two most important people. Mahasi is responsible for the introduction of meditation to Sri Lanka, which has not been practiced there, to Thailand, also from there the meditation movement started, and of course to the West. After independence, the Prime Minister U Nu practiced meditation himself. He introduced Buddhism as a state religion, and he ordered Mahasi to establish a even well-known meditation center until today, which is still existing today. Then the famous United Nations General Secretary U Thant from Myanmar also practiced meditation, and today the opposition politician Aung San Suu Kyi again is a student of Mahasi and is practicing his meditation. And lastly, in 2008, the monk revolution against the military regime, which was first of all defeated bloodily, this monk revolution also was based on the meditation of Vipassana as taught by Mahasi. Another point would be in the next semester, if I'm again allowed to give a lecture, then I would step over and see how now Westerners, especially Theosophists, related to these concepts which have been developed in Myanmar. Thank you.